This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, March 29th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Sarah Gonzalez. Todd and I are filling in together for John Hockenberry today. John is back tomorrow.
And we begin this hour with a look at internet privacy rules. It's no secret that internet consumers are often willing to consent to user agreements before they bother to read the fine print. So it might be surprising to you to know that internet service providers like Verizon and Comcast are currently free to sell data from users' browsing history to advertisers.
During the final months of the Obama presidency, the Federal Communications Commission created a set of regulations aimed at granting internet privacy protections to the public. Those rules would have required internet service providers to get permission from users before selling their private data to advertisers. But it doesn't look like that will happen. Those protections are set to be one of the casualties of the Republican-led Congress's rollback of federal regulations. Last week, in a 50-48 party line vote, the Senate moved to repeal the internet privacy regulations. And yesterday, the House also voted in favor of the repeal, following a debate filled with urgent pleas by Democrats like California Representative Anna Eshoo.
This is a big one. This is really a big one. Congress is poised today to betray the American people on one of the issues they care the most about, their privacy. Their privacy. Every single one of us cares about it, and so do the American people.
Dallas Harris is a policy fellow at Public Knowledge. It's a nonpartisan consumer advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. She joins me now to explain how concerned internet users should be about this renewed loss of privacy. Dallas Harris, hi, and welcome to The Takeaway.
Well, thanks for having me.
What kind of personal data do internet service providers want to use?
Well, they want to use every piece of personal data that they can get their hands on.
Okay.
So that includes every website you visit, your geolocation, any information about your health, finances, about children, things that we would traditionally consider sensitive, they want to use without getting your permission first, essentially.
And how would they use it?
For marketing. Internet service providers, I like to say, they want to be the new Mad Men. They want to be the new big advertisers on the block. And they feel that they have some sort of right to be able to use the information they collect about you to make additional money through advertising revenue streams.
The protections that were put in place by Obama haven't actually gone into effect, though, that are meant to protect our privacy. They were supposed to go into effect later this year. So is this repeal something that consumers will actually feel?
Well, I do think they will actually feel this. The big difference between then and now, although the rules hadn't gone into effect, is that we had a Federal Communications Commission that was ready and willing to first make rules about privacy, put internet service providers on notice that they would be serious about regulating privacy. And now we have a Federal Communications Commission and a majority there that has made it clear that internet service providers will not be under any strict standards. So regardless of the fact that the rules haven't come into effect, there will be some real difference on how internet service providers perceive their obligations under the law.
Overturning the privacy protections is considered a victory for the internet service providers. They celebrated the House vote yesterday. But Dallas, what's the strongest argument in favor of internet providers being able to sell our online history to advertisers?
Well, I really struggle to find one. And you know, what's important here is to note that the rules didn't prohibit them from selling personal information. It just said they needed to ask their customers first. I find that to be an extremely reasonable request on behalf of internet service providers, that they simply just ask you before they use your information, especially your sensitive information. Internet service providers, they argue that, well, other companies like Google or Facebook or other websites that are on the edge of the internet get to use your information in different ways because they're regulated by the Federal Trade Commission. But the truth is, internet service providers hold a privileged position where they are the gatekeeper between you and access to the internet. So they necessarily need to be more responsible and more responsive to their customers' needs.
Why do internet service providers have different standards than phone and cable companies and also internet companies like Google or like Netflix?
Well, they're subject to different parts of the law, right? So internet service providers are subject to Section 222 of the Telecommunications Act. Other sites like Facebook, Google, they simply are not under that section of the law. And the Federal Trade Commission regulates those entities. There is a free market out there for web services. There is no free market when it comes to your internet service provider. Most people only have access to one or two. So the regulatory schemes are a bit different. And if we are to make sure internet service providers are on a level playing field with others, then really what we need to do is up that level of protection, not have a race to the bottom.
Do you think that the regulations would have really done much to help consumer privacy? I mean, we know that a lot of the user agreements, we sort of agree to them without really reading them.
That is a big problem that we are constantly thinking about, right? The long legalese type disclosures. But I do think that if consumers were presented with the proposition beforehand, we want to use your information to market you better shoes, right? To give you more relevant advertisements. There are plenty of consumers out there who will make the choice, right? The question is just, do they have informed consent? And, you know, as long as the customer is willing to do so, then I have no qualms with that. And if the information is presented to the customer up front, there is no question that they will automatically feel in more control over how their information is used. And that was the goal of these rules.
And for internet consumers who want maybe a little bit more control, what are some services available for internet users who want to encrypt or hide their browsing activity?
Yeah, well, you know, this is a really tough issue. So everyone could go out and get a VPN, a virtual private network. The problem is then you just trade off all of your information to your VPN provider instead of your internet service provider. So you could do that if you are tech savvy enough, if you happen to have the spare change to get a VPN. But that's not the case for everybody. And I really think the way that we should be thinking about it is that it's internet service providers' obligations to keep our privacy protected. And the moment that people feel they have to take their privacy into their own hands to this degree, that's a failure of public policy.
Hey, Dallas Harris is a policy fellow at Public Knowledge. It's a nonpartisan consumer advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. Dallas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So Congress, in its wisdom, has decided it's time to let internet service providers sell your browsing history and app usage. To author Ramesh Srinivasan, it's just one of many signs that we've gotten used to an internet that's very different from the one we experienced just a few years ago.
As it's scaled out, right, we're talking about 4 billion people approximately with access to the internet in different forms. As it scaled out, it became increasingly sort of dominated, I believe, by major intermediaries, if you will, that is, platforms that actually structure and influence our experience of the internet. So we're thinking about examples like Google, of course, earlier, and now Facebook as well.
Ramesh Srinivasan traveled the world to write Who's Global Village, Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. He says the internet hasn't completely lost its democratizing egalitarian qualities, but that clearly the people aren't in control.
Well, I think the internet was born, you know, as a sort of certain type of countercultural space where we could create our own content and share it in a really democratic and grassroots-based way. Remember that word surf that we all used
sure.
to use, where we'd kind of browse around and we'd have more of a feeling of serendipity, and we'd experience information in a way that felt more sort of determined by our own will and by a feeling of randomness, if you will. But now information is being pushed onto us, right, through algorithms, and you're not really sure about what the mechanisms are by which information is coming to you. It's just so overwhelming to actually think about a sort of surf model with an internet that has just exponentialized in its vastness in terms of the amount of information it produces. And so that actually makes these platforms that influence what information is retrieved to you in what ways all the more important, and actually in many ways economically, politically, and culturally powerful in a way that at times escapes us as the users of the internet, our grasp and our visibility.
Right. And so we have this version of the internet that you describe, which only wants your aggregated information to make money for shareholders, through Facebook, which does largely the same thing. We've just talked about a couple of minutes ago bills in Congress that would let ISPs sell people's browser history. This is not a democratized but a corporate internet. And I guess maybe it's a cynical question, but were we naive to think that it would ever be anything different? I mean, this is the way we do things.
Well, this is sort of the history in many ways of media in this country, right? I mean, sort of every layer of media in this country followed certain types of patterns where certain forces, especially commercial forces, consolidated their power and their ownership, what we call political economy. The internet, though, was something different in the sense that it actually created the possibility for all of us as users to be authors, to be producers, to be editors, perhaps to even influence how we choose to find information and to represent ourselves. But it is increasingly moving in this direction of sort of platform consolidation. And this is something we need to check. But that's why policy and certain forms of grassroots activism and public outcry is all the more important, particularly in this moment, I believe.
So before I let you go, Ramesh Srinivasan, you play a little game with me just for a second. I want to play Matrix with you. You know, I close my eyes and I think about what the internet would be if I were inside it. And I'd like to think of it as a giant library where I can grab any book I want and no one can stop me. I realize that's naive, especially after reading your book. When you close your eyes in your Matrix, knowing what you know about what the internet is, what does it look like?
It feels a little bit to me like walking through, you know, a giant server farm in Iceland, perhaps, where you're walking into this space and you see machines and machines and machines all around you. And you know that they're incredibly powerful computationally. You know that they're storing your data. You know that various sorts of technological and political forces are interacting with those machines, but you don't really feel like you necessarily have a lot of control over what's happening in this incredibly intense kind of dark technological environment. So that said, even though I gave you a doom and gloom answer, I don't believe that this is the way the internet has to be or the way we have to go with the internet. I think now more than ever, we have to fight for the values that are incredibly powerful around what democracy is, what our society is, and what the internet can and should be.
Ramesh Srinivasan is author of Whose Global Village? Rethinking How Technology Shapes Our World. Ramesh, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Todd. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hey, I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
And I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today. Some responses from you now on internet privacy.
This is Nicole from Dover, New Hampshire. I think it should be illegal for anyone to use my online information without my consent. I depend on technology, and I want legal protection of my data so that I can use technology without fearing that people are collecting it.
We got this from Provo, Utah. My online privacy is very important to me because I work as a cam girl. Keeping my life separate from work is essential to my safety. You can always tweet us at The Takeaway, and for a complete list of all the ways you can take part in the show, check out the Connect with The Takeaway button on our website at thetakeaway.org.
No one knows how this is going to go. It's a gamble. It's a risk. It's a bit like Trump. It's such an uncertain place at the moment. No one knows how it's going to go.
Hey, bye-bye. Hey, bye-bye. Hey, bye-bye.
Britain begins the process of exiting the European Union today. That means Northern Ireland, which is still a part of the United Kingdom, is leaving the EU, even though they voted overwhelmingly against it. The Republic of Ireland is its own country and still a member of the EU. For decades, sectarian violence between Catholics and Protestants devastated the region. The two countries were separated by a hard border, nearly 300 checkpoints, and a heavy military presence. That violence, along with the checkpoints, ended with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998.
Good evening from Castle Buildings at Stormont outside Belfast on the day of a truly momentous agreement. promising a fundamental change in the political relationship between North and South and between Britain and Ireland.
And residents in Ireland and Northern Ireland have gotten used to moving freely between the two places. Philip Martin is a senior reporter at our partner station, WGBH, in Boston. He recently traveled to Belfast in Northern Ireland and to Dublin in the Republic of Ireland, and he spoke with people about Brexit and what it might mean for their border.
The Prime Minister of Ireland, Enda Kenny, told me that regardless of its neighbor to the north being pulled against its will out of the EU by the vote in England, that there would be no return to what he said would be the bad old days of border guards, train passports, identity checkpoints, and custom controls. But regular Irish folks on both sides of the border aren't so sure. I mean, the citizens of the north and the south, they're used to passing through these borders, not being asked for anything, unmolested. And when you're on the train, you don't hear you're now entering Northern Ireland. Nothing of that sort. Stuart McPhee, who's a resident of Dublin and a photographer, I met him traveling from Dublin to Northern Ireland by train. And he says he sees hundreds of commuters from the north on this route each week and believes they will definitely be impacted.
This train that we're on now, the Belfast Enterprise, operated by Northern Ireland Railways, express service to Dublin, is in the early morning packed, overflowing with people. All the seats are taken, all of the aisles are full with people standing. And these are all people commuting from the north to Dublin for work.
Philip, what was it like when there was a hard border with nearly 300 checkpoints separating the two countries?
You had police everywhere. You had British military everywhere. And what you see now, I mean, the difference, the reason that Brexit has had such incredible impact is because of the EU. You see this newfound prosperity taking place both in the north and the south. You see construction taking place everywhere. And when you think about Belfast, Northern Ireland, of course, you think strictly of the wall in West Belfast, and you think of Protestants and Catholics clashing. There's still that antipathy toward each other, but most people are focused on somewhere else. So you see folks hanging out in outdoor cafes. You see people basically reveling in a new type of prosperity. And because many young people in the north see their futures possibly impacted negatively by the Brexit vote, those in Northern Ireland, they're making a beeline to Dublin to get Irish citizenship and passport privileges. I spoke with a student named Nathan Callahan. He was sitting outside a bar in downtown Belfast, Northern Ireland, and he essentially said that this is going to impact him personally.
The cost of living and stuff in the north, you know, it is going to increase because, you know, trying to get goods from within the EU is going to be harder to get.
If you're no longer part of the EU, and he's very concerned about that, so concerned that he's even considering immigrating.
What about concerns over the border between North and South impacting the politics of the region?
The politics will be impacted. As I mentioned, the peace wall that still separates West Belfast Protestants and Catholic nationalists. But you hear folks on both sides in recent years have basically been focused on improving livelihoods. However, there is a push, a new push for Irish reunification. Brexit, in the view of many nationalists, would likely bring about a return of a hard border. That's not necessarily true, but that's the belief. And possibly a return of the British Army. But Brexit has also brought opportunity for Irish Republicans. And that worries folks like a Protestant taxi driver I spoke with who views himself as English, and he voted for Brexit. He worries about the reimposition of a hard border and how that might play into the hands of nationalists. He said there would obviously be a checkpoint, but I can't see the borders being put back. But he says he fears that we might go back to a time when 1,500 bombs a year in the early days of the conflict and where people had to be searched, women and children. Now, a lot of people don't share his view. And folks believe that there would be problems, but not everyone is worried about a return to violence.
Philip, there's a lot of talk coming out of Scotland about holding a second independence referendum because of the Brexit vote, which the Scots opposed overwhelmingly. Is there a similar move being considered in Belfast in terms of reuniting with the Republic?
Sarah, this is what you call irony, because when England voted for Brexit, English voters voted 53% for Brexit last summer and celebrated its passage. Westminster clearly did not gauge the level of pushback from Belfast and Glasgow. I mean, while we, for example, here in the United States were focused on the latest Trump tweet, few here seem to take notice that Sinn Féin in Belfast came within one seat of overtaking the Democratic Unionist Party. as the largest political party in Northern Ireland. That's seismic. And this pushes the Nationalists that much closer to their goal, the goal they've always held of a unified Ireland that includes its six counties in the north. Now, it's hard to know how this is all going to end, but Brexit has had a short-term effect, at least, not appreciated by its proponents. And that is the irony of English nationalists. Think about this. The irony of English nationalist efforts to seal their own borders having the effect of firing up nationalist movements in Scotland and Northern Ireland and possibly reestablishing borders in areas of the United Kingdom that had all but ceased to exist.
Philip Martin is WGBH senior reporter. Philip, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Sarah.
I'm Todd Zwillick here with Sarah Gonzalez today. The Final Four for the NCAA Men's Basketball Championships are all set. UNC is back for a record 20th time. Oregon's in there for the second time, and you have newcomers South Carolina and Gonzaga as well. The fans are rushing to Arizona for the games this weekend, and meanwhile, the ongoing national debate over whether players should be paid in this billion-dollar business continues. Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, and he's taking this a step further. He's pushing for players to strike at the Final Four. Zirin says Wisconsin would have been the most likely team to push for it had they made it to the Final Four. But the strongest argument for player pay can be found when you see who's already being rewarded in the system.
John Wooden, in 1975, the greatest college coach in the world at UCLA, made $35,000. Mike Krzyzewski, the top paid coach today, makes $7.5 million. How has a business changed so much that a $35,000 a year job is now a $7.5 million a year job? And if the situation has changed so much, why is the situation of the athlete not only similar to what it was in 1975, but actually in some respects worse, because the value of a scholarship is actually far less for a big-time college athlete than it was in 1975 because of more games, more travel, more demands on their time.
Now, let's imagine for a second the Final Four comes, everybody's got their brackets, then a protest comes. What would be the fan reaction and the national reaction to this type of situation, do you think?
Profoundly polarized, because when you look at the polls, majority of Black Americans support the idea of NCAA players getting paid, which is not surprising because the optics of NCAA basketball and football are so stark in the idea of who's on the field, who's getting paid, who's not, but also a plurality of white Americans as well. We saw the same thing just recently with Colin Kaepernick kneeling during the anthem, in that he was decried by people across the country, political leaders, yet at the same time, he had the best-selling jersey in the National Football League.
And we should remind ourselves, you mentioned that 82% of the NCAA's budget comes from March Madness, but this is a $1 billion a year operation.
Oh, yeah. And if you look at the full contract, you're into the tens of billions of dollars in terms of what the NCAA receives. I would also point out that this organization, I would call it a cartel, but this organization that controls college athletics operates out of a new $50 million headquarters in Indianapolis. They've got a ton of vice presidents who make six figures. So you are talking about a situation that is like Scrooge McDuck, you know, diving inside the gold coins, and yet the people who are actually paid to see are the ones who are on the outside looking in.
Okay, where does this end, Dave Zirin? It makes some sense for college basketball, college football players who are generating vast amounts of revenue to demand to get paid. But there are college athletes right down the ranks, and I say down, not pejoratively, but maybe in terms of spectators, college lacrosse, college curling, college fencing, tennis players. They get paid as well?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things about collective bargaining. These things would have to be discussed. Like, would there be a stipend? Would playing sports be seen as a work study? But when we're talking about the revenue-producing athletes themselves, the biggest issue is that the money is already there. It's just about who gets it and where the money goes. When we talk about administrators, when you talk about compliance officers to make sure everybody, you know, bows to the whip of these arcane rules, when you talk about salaries, the exploding salaries of the head coaches and assistant coaches in basketball and in football, that's where you start to see where the money actually is, and you start to answer the question of who gets it and who doesn't without hurting those non-revenue sports.
All right, so let's look forward to Final Four weekend before we let you go, Dave Zirin. The chances of a strike happening are probably low, but what kind of attention do you think this ongoing issue, and it is ongoing, gets this time around? Do you expect the public to be any more engaged in the issue of college athletes being exploited and then paid than they have in the past?
It's going to depend on what the players say and do in the lead up to the Final Four. We had a huge discussion about this several years ago when UConn made the Final Four and won the championship, when their star guard Shabazz Napier talked about actually being hungry on campus and being unable to get food. You know, that really rocked people and led to a broader discussion. That, unfortunately, is what it takes. The people who have the most to lose and the least power being the ones who are out front speaking out.
Dave Zirin, sports editor at The Nation magazine, host of Edge of Sports. Great to have you as always, Dave.
Thank you so much, Todd.
The U.S. women's national hockey team will play in their world championship this year. The team had deadlocked in a 15-month contract dispute with USA Hockey, and they threatened to boycott the tournament earlier this year when talks stalled. But the threat worked. Hockey players from colleges to recreational players and even high school players turned down offers to step in as a replacement team. Instead, they stood in solidarity with the defending world champs. Now the women have a livable wage, reportedly about $70,000 a year. That's up from $6,000 every 4 years. And now the women are on par with the men's team on travel stipends and accommodations. USA Hockey also agreed to improve their marketing efforts for the women's team and to start providing support for elite girls programs. Jocelyn Lamoureux-Davidson is a forward on the national team. She spoke with us from Fargo International Airport on her way to Plymouth, Michigan to start training for the World Championships. They start Friday.
To be able to train and skate the way we need to without it being the financial burden moving forward, I think is going to be very, very beneficial for our team. But it's also going to change how our team moves forward, what players will do with their career, because hopefully it's not a financial burden anymore. But then it's also going to change the landscape for the next generation coming up.
And talk to me about the men's hockey team. How do they get paid?
The men's national team, they don't get paid because they play in the NHL. So they get, you know, paid by their NHL salaries, which, you know, are millions of dollars. And so we took the stance that we wanted equitable support. So how they travel, meals per diem, accommodations, disability insurance, all those things that they were providing the men, we felt by the Ted Stevens Amateur Sports Act, they are obligated to provide that for us. And so we were able to accomplish that in the agreement. And then we just feel like there's also going to be a trickle-down effect, and it's going to impact the younger generation. We're going to have more publicity, more marketing, which is a piece to the puzzle. And so we're very excited moving forward.
And talk to me about your organizing effort. USA Women's National Hockey players threatened to boycott the World Championships. USA Hockey threatened to then bring in replacements for the players. And Jocelyn, you and other female players reached out to college and high school players and recreational players to persuade them not to be the backup team.
Yeah, we were in contact with all the Division I and Division III coaches. Without all the support that we had, this wouldn't have been able to happen. We know so many players that turned down offers to play starting Friday. And so without everyone standing with us, we probably wouldn't be here today. And so that we are very grateful for.
What did that feel like?
It was very overwhelming in a positive way. Just the support that came our way from the players, coaches, just everywhere, not just in the sporting world. And so, and then to understand, like, that's not an easy for a college kid or a high school kid to say no to it, that it's a once in a lifetime opportunity. But I think it also speaks volumes for what we were fighting for. People were hearing us. And to know that it was going to impact them probably more so than the current players now, I think is why everyone was willing to stand with us in this.
Your first game on Friday is against Canada?
Yep. I'm excited. Going to try and get some sleep on this next flight. And then just excited to see everyone get back on the ice, see everyone for the first time since this all has kind of happened the last couple weeks. And so yesterday was a whirlwind, just getting everything finalized. And now I think we're all just relieved that we can go to the rink, focus on what we love doing, and prepare to defend our world championship.
And just before I let you go, how did you get into hockey?
I have four older brothers that played, and so basically my sister and I, we just chased them around and did whatever they did, and so without them, hockey probably wouldn't have been our sport of choosing, but I would say just following them around growing up, just love the game.
Jocelyn, thank you so much, and good luck on Friday.
Thank you very much.
Jocelyn Lamoureux-Davidson is a forward on the women's national team. Her sister, Monique Lamoureux-Mirando, also plays on the team.
The jury is out.
The jury has spoken, and they have sent an unmistakable message.
We, the jury. The
jury will reach a verdict.
It's not my problem. It's up to a jury to decide.
Now, you as jurors sit as judges of the evidence. You're called the trier of fact.
It's the process.
You're going to be stuck in that motel for weeks.
If you're worried about how this country is going, jury duty is how you fix it.
No jury can declare a man guilty unless it's sure.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez in with Todd Zwillick. Earlier this month, the Supreme Court addressed racial discrimination in the courtroom by peeking into the jury deliberation room. The court ruled that if there's evidence of racial bias tainting jury deliberations, the secrecy of those deliberations can be thrown out, as can the verdict. It's a step forward, many say, in improving the way our system serves justice.
Like a lot of African Americans, I am sick and tired of being sick and tired. I encourage any juror who thinks the police or prosecutors have crossed the line in a particular case to refuse to convict.
That's Georgetown law professor and a former federal prosecutor, Paul Butler, reading from a piece he wrote last year in the Washington Post in the context of what he and so many others call the two justice systems of America, the one for white people and the one for black people. And when black jurors suspect bias or injustice, Butler says they have the power to send a message that the system needs to change. It's a practice known as jury nullification. That's when jurors refuse to convict. And he witnessed it firsthand when he was a federal prosecutor. As part of our series of Our Peers, looking at the jury system in America, we spoke with Paul Butler and got his take on why refusing to convict, while maybe underused, still has a place in our justice system.
If you go to criminal court in D.C., Sarah, you would think that white people don't commit crimes. White people don't use drugs. They don't get into fights. They don't steal, because all you see is African-American people. There are a number of jurors in D.C. who at that time were mainly African-American who thought that there was something that was fundamentally unfair. And so if it was a nonviolent drug case with an African-American defendant, often they would refuse to convict. We didn't see this a lot in violent crimes or property crimes, but in drug possession cases, you saw it all the time. When I left the prosecutor office and became a professor, it was the first thing I wanted to study. And I found out that this practice of jury nullification is not only perfectly legal, it's actually a proud part of our constitutional tradition. It's one of the many things that led to the end of slavery, because it was a crime for a slave to run away. It was a crime to help a slave run away. Northern jurors would refuse to convict in those cases. Mm. You know, when I was a prosecutor, it was a crime in D.C., if you can believe this, for people of the same gender to have consensual sex. D.C. jurors had the good sense to refuse to convict in those cases. Of course, there's famous examples of when jury nullification has been used the wrong way, like when people were violent against civil rights workers in the South. So at the end of the day, jury nullification is like any other power. It can be used for good or it can be used for evil.
And what kind of cases do you think this should apply to, refusing to convict, jury nullification? Where do you draw the line?
I draw the line in a case with a violent crime when the jurors are persuaded beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant has intentionally hurt someone, then I think they should convict. And I'm really thinking of drug crimes where there's so much evidence of discrimination against African Americans. Sarah, you know, I work at a college campus, so everybody there knows that black people don't use drugs more than anybody else. According to the National Institute of Health, we're about 13% of people who use or sell drugs. But if you go here in D.C. to the Justice Department and ask who's locked up for that crime, 60% black. 13% of people who do the crime, 60% of people who do the time. Again, that's just straight out discrimination. And so I think that's a prime case where jurors should use their power to send a message that that's just unacceptable.
How would you make our jury system more fair today? How would you make it take better care of all of the people involved in the process?
So the first thing is that jurors need to be more diverse. Juries need to be more diverse. It's not good enough to just draw jurors from, say, driver's licenses or property roles, because a lot of people in the community don't have a car or a license. People of color might not own their own home, so they might not be on their tax rolls. So we have to look at a large number of indexes of people in the community, people who receive public assistance, people who are in homeless shelters. The more diverse a jury is, the more likely it is to consider everybody's point of view and to render a just verdict. You know, another thing, Sarah, is we can't allow prosecutors to get away with excluding jurors of color the way they do now. The Supreme Court said in a case called Batson that that's unconstitutional, but that's like the most unfollowed constitutional rule of all time, in part because the standard is so low. There was one case in which a prosecutor excluded a Latino juror. The defense brought a Batson case against him. The prosecutor said, well, I'm not excluding him because he's Latino. I'm excluding him because he speaks Spanish. And the judge said, oh, well, that's race neutral. That's an okay reason to exclude him. That's ludicrous. And the final thing is that in the voir dire process, that's the process in which potential jurors are questioned, we've got to give defense attorneys more space to ask about race and bias. Of course, if you ask anybody these days, are you prejudiced? Are you racist? They're going to say no. So we have to allow defense attorneys a lot more latitude to try to get at this very real problem of bias against people of color.
Paul, I have to ask you, though, you say that people of color are not selected for jury duty because there's a perception that they're not going to convict other people of color. But at the same time, you're also encouraging black jurors not to convict other black jurors. So how do you balance these two statements?
One thing that jury nullification does is encourage prosecutors to bring more just cases. So in jurisdictions like the Bronx, like Oakland, like Washington, D.C., where there are a lot of jurors of color, prosecutors tend to be more selective in the cases that they bring. So I think that knowing there are these jurors out there who are going to exercise their constitutional power to look at a particular case and think about whether punishment is deserved, if prosecutors understand that, that's going to encourage them to bring cases that are more responsive to the community needs. In our democracy, that's just what we need. At the end of the day, what jurors of color say is that when it comes to criminal justice, what's good enough for white people is good enough for us.
Paul Butler is a law professor at Georgetown University School of Law. He is a former federal prosecutor and the author of the forthcoming book, Chokehold Policing Black Men. Paul, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
At the start of the week, Andrew Ferguson kicked off our series of Our Peers and joined the show to explore how we might choose more fair juries by using data about jurors' online habits, for example. Ferguson is a law professor at the UDC David A. Clark School of Law and author of Why Jury Duty Matters. And now we've brought him back to respond to listener questions from you about the jury experience and the system at large. Andrew, thanks for coming back and taking our questions.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, Andrew, we've gotten lots of questions about how juries are chosen from Chicago, Illinois. How up-to-date is the system in terms of eligible jurors? How do we keep it as representative of the current community members as possible?
It's a good question, and unfortunately it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Many courts are supposed to annually update their lists, but it doesn't always happen. One of the realities is that, you know, not only do you have a very mobile culture, people move all over the place, but many times courts are just not as technologically advanced as the rest of the world, and they don't have the investment or the infrastructure to catch up with our mobile culture.
Okay, how about the question of pay? Hearing lots about that.
Hi, it's Grant from Charlotte, North Carolina. I'm curious why jury duty doesn't pay more, and why isn't there a system in place to select more unemployed people since they should be available?
Juror pay is one of the biggest problems in the whole jury process. It is a symbol of the fact that we don't invest very much in jury service. Think about it. Even from an educational investment, what information do you have before you get to jury service? Almost none. I always joke that you actually have to do more to adopt a pet in Washington, D.C. than serve on a jury. There are citizens who are taking time out of their lives. They have bills to pay. They have jobs to meet and obligations. And many courts don't even pay enough money to cover parking or the transportation to get down to the courthouse. It's a function of investment, and it's something that we can change. There has been a push to up the juror pay in certain cities and jurisdictions, but of course it costs money to do so. And we should think creatively about figuring out better ways to deal with the pay problem, which is real.
And two related questions here from a listener in Florida. How do I get excused from a jury? And then from Livingston, Alabama, how do we have an equitable jury system when most people try to get out of jury duty?
Well, I think that those questions are obviously related. To the questioner who wants to get out, I would ask you to rethink why. Jury service is the closest most American citizens can come to sort of living the principles of the Constitution. Most of us believe in the Constitution. Most of us believe in the ideas of liberty and democracy and deliberation and participation. And this is an opportunity to sort of see that in work. And so the idea of trying to get out of it is trying to get out of your democratic obligation. And it is a problem because if you look at jury summonses and you look at jury processes, there's a good percentage of people who are trying to get out. And that means the burden rests on the other people. It means there are certain segments of the population who aren't represented. And if you are a defendant, if you are a plaintiff, if you are someone who has come to the court system to have justice done and people are trying to get out, it is damaging to the fairness and it's damaging to the whole system. This is our system, our democratic system, our civic system. And we should all be obliged to contribute to it and not look for ways to get out, but look for ways to contribute more because that's what being an American is all about.
Okay, here's another question. Take a listen.
I've always thought that the only way I would end up in front of a jury was if I was innocent and accused of a crime I didn't commit. I've been told by many that if I choose a jury trial, I'm subject to their irrational whims, and that the best bet is to waive jury trial and accept a judge's verdict. Is this true?
So I was a trial lawyer for 9 years, and I would, having watched those jurors, I would never waive a jury trial. If I were charged with a crime, if I were innocent, I would ask a jury of my peers to decide that case. Because I think when you get 12 people together, 12 people are approaching a question fresh who don't come in with preconceived notions of the criminal justice system or the person sitting in that defendant's chair, they take it seriously. And they recognize the difficulty of making that decision. They follow the law. And, you know, almost all the time they get it right.
Here is a tough one.
Bill Linford, Ogden, Utah. To the extent that we have such data, do we know how often juries get it right? That is, how often are their verdicts correct compared to how often their verdicts are incorrect? Also, do we have any data to show if juries make decisions any better or worse than a judge does?
So going back to literally the 1960s, there have been social scientists who have studied that question about whether juries get it right. And by and large, the studies show that they do get it right. And what get it right means is, are they the same as a judge who would be deciding it at the same time? We don't have an objective, did they get it right or wrong? We don't know that. But generally speaking, judges, who are some of the biggest fans of juries you will ever find, say that 9 times out of 10, jurors get it right. And when they might differ from judges, they differ in a way that the judges understand and sort of create part of the reason why we have a jury system. Sometimes there are sort of empathetic or personal reasons why a jury might be more lenient than a judge, and the judges understand that. So if you ask judges, do jurors get it right? They say yes. If you ask social scientists, do jurors get it right? You say yes. And with the exception of sort of the, you know, mass media attack on jury service that, you know, is part of the current conversation, the people on the ground who are doing this work recognize that juries get it right over and over again.
Okay, and a lot of people are wondering this one, Andrew, from New York, New York. How can we improve the jury system so that people will not dread the notifications? I can't relate to those people.
You know, I think we need to reshape how we view jury service in America. I think we should think of it as not just jury duty, but constitution duty. It is our obligation to connect with the principles that made this country great. If you look at, you know, where juries come from and why we have them, they're literally in the Constitution, Article 3, and then the Sixth Amendment, the Seventh Amendment. It is the only right that makes a repeat appearance in the actual bill, the text of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. It's part of our history. It was part of the women's suffrage movement. It's part of the civil rights movement. It is part of who we are as an American. And we should think about that as we approach jury service. So instead of saying, oh, no, I have to take time out of my busy life to do this service, you say, like, this is why I'm an American. This is part of the only thing I have to do. The only constitutional obligation you have to do is serve on a jury. You don't have to vote. You don't have to make enough money to pay taxes. But you do have to serve on a jury. And there's a reason why. Because we count on citizens to make the ultimate judgment about what should happen in our laws, because that's what a democracy is all about.
Andrew Ferguson is a law professor at the UDC David A. Clark School of Law and author of Why Jury Duty Matters. Andrew, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
And here's something to take with you today. We've already alerted you here on the show that President Trump's border wall could shape up into a nasty confrontation in Washington next month. Meanwhile, they're building walls in his hometown. Not for an immigration crackdown, though. These are for art.
Famous Chinese artist Ai Weiwei has plans to build more than 100 fences and fence-inspired installations all around New York City this fall. The project is set to include fences and walls, large and small.
Now, Ai Weiwei told the New York Times that far more countries have border walls and fences now than when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989. He said, "We're witnessing a rise in nationalism, an increase in the closure of borders, and an exclusionary attitude toward migrants and refugees, the victims of war, and the casualties of globalization. So, in the name of art in New York, we say, Mr. Ai Weiwei, build up that wall."
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
And I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. We've had a lot of fun teaming up, filling in for John, but he's back tomorrow. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com. By Squarespace, a website building platform that helps anyone register a domain and create their own website. More at squarespace.com. Squarespace, make your next move. Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.